This is Talk of Asian Marketing with a special emphasis on localized Chinese consumer behavior. Our website is ccc.qbook.tv, where you can find other audio and video episodes with photos, links, and information related to today's conversation. Subscribe to leave comments and access research episodes with applied topics and research reports. Welcome back to Talk of Asian Marketing on the Chinese Consumer Connection website. And today, I am joined by Professor James Stanworth from National Zhonghua University of Education. James, how you doing?
Clyde, I'm great. I always enjoy getting together and doing our podcast in the video cast. You must be real excited to be over in Beijing right now.
Yeah, I was just going to say, we're both in China. You're down in Shanghai, and I'm up north in Beijing, and it is a very beautiful weather. Springtime, early spring, not cold, not too hot, perfect weather.
Yeah, the weather's been quite good to us, I have to say, and it's nice over here in Shanghai. I was just out by the Bund yesterday evening. That was real nice. So nice place just to chill out a little bit in the bustle of the city.
Interesting. In fact, I was just showing some pictures from there. I was talking to some people at Procter & Gamble, and I was showing them some retail photos. And what I loved is I had some photos of downtown with shops doing those very big sales and vats of items out on the sidewalk. All the things you would not associate with the very high end right down there next to Armani, but there it is nonetheless.
Yeah, it's I always love this. You have that very thin veneer, don't you, of the upper end, like, as you say, the Armani kind of stuff. But that, as we've talked about in one of our other shows, that fairly thin upper end retail soon dissipates into the very Chinese outside in kind of inside out, I should say, kind of approach.
Yeah, right. Of course, we're used to that inside in. But what we talked about is that inside out. I think show 29, Globalization of Nothing. I think you and I were out at a department store downtown Shanghai.
That's it. And I love it. You start at the bottom. You have these big name brands, and then as you migrate upwards, then it all becomes very much more localized often, even in these very, very big kind of plush looking chains.
Even there. Which tells me that, you know, the luxury market, which everyone always talks about, is there. But, you know, let's think about that for a minute. I think that leads into our topic today. Certainly, there's no doubt that whole China region is flush with cash. I mean, that's obvious. Did you know that one of the biggest, well, off the top of your head, if I was to ask you, who's the biggest buyer of U.S. bonds, you know, to support their deficit? I think everybody would know that would be
China.
I think every school child knows this, right? But did you know? Did you know Taiwan is still one of the top three buyers? So is Singapore.
Now that Taiwan, I didn't know. I mean, I think hidden underneath that outer facade, yeah, is that real economic strength that people can easily forget. So yeah.
I think the point there is that, you know, even in an economy like Taiwan, which is of course very close to China, a lot of parallels there. Development way earlier, and I think when I first moved there, you had all that nouveau riche, which we're experiencing now in China. Even 20 years later, you know, these places are flush with cash, and they're buying, you know, the debt to support the deficit of countries like the UK and the US. Which means people save a lot of money, James.
That's right, and at the other end, people get poorer. They talk of austerity in UK, and now we're talking flush with cash in China.
This is kind of a philosophy. We need to have another show just on the philosophy of the economics of buy now or buy later, right?
Yes.
Which one makes you richer?
Or even buy never, which of course is...
Or in the U.S., buy now and pay never pay would be the idea, I think. So this idea of all this cash floating around, and a lot of people then, I think, in the West say, well, then everyone in China and Taiwan and these places must be loaded. But, you know, James, the way I like to think about it is it's like a water balloon, right? You press down in one place, the water flows to another part, pops up another place. I think what we see is in Taiwan we can see this very clearly. In China it's very obvious. It's that there's a lot of savings and people are very careful with their money, but then other things just become so expensive and no one really ends up that much ahead, especially on the consumption side. And I think today what we're going to look at is where a big, huge chunk of people's money, worries, concerns go to.
Which, of course, is housing. I mean, it's that very practical problem. You know, you have to solve a few things in life, don't you, Clive? Which starts with putting food and drink in your mouth and putting shelter over your head. So we're right in that space today, which is solving the dilemma and the problem of getting a place to stay. And the housing market is quite an interesting one to look at. You know, you've got that fundamental need to solve that problem. And often for Chinese, it's not just solving it for their immediate family, but often it's the extended family, mum, dad, maybe moving in or may have lived with them already for a long time. It's the issue that quite often families are sort of split up in the sense that mum or dad may be working in the north and the rest of the family's in the south. So they've got two housing needs to take care of. So it's quite an interesting space. And then you add in our perspective as well as expats living and working here. And you've then got that issue of, you know, solving the same housing problem, but with the added issue of, do I want to put all my money into that kind of housing need? So I think it's quite an interesting need problem to look at and think about from all those kind of perspectives.
Yeah, I think that we can begin from a kind of departure point just to say that I do not own, I don't think you own either. Right,
absolutely right. I'm laughing here because I'm just thinking of your place back in Taiwan, Clyde, and you know, the first thing you say is it's very, very local.
Yeah, well,
and the second thing you tell me is how cheap it is.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I've been renting for 20 years in Taiwan, and we've been out into the market to buy multiple times. In the early 90s, we went out. In the mid-90s, we went out. And now we're out again looking around. So we've been very active. It kind of comes in waves where you feel the pressure and you go out and look around. Then you get depressed and you come back and skip it. And I think, of course, in different cultures, now maybe I'm wrong, but I think different cultures and different sociological kind of situations give preferences to the buy and rent question above and beyond just the economic consideration. So, of course, for Chinese, this is really one of your big, big purchases, and it is really a public face thing. Now, I think I need to emphasize something here, though, James, and maybe you've seen this. For Chinese, though, even though they buy a house and it's quote-unquote part of their face, saving face, they don't actually invite people to their homes very much. Have you been to many other professors' homes?
No, it's a very unusual thing, isn't it, if you're invited to a local person's house. I mean, typically in the West, we get quite used to even, you know, colleagues and so on inviting them to our home to eat. That's pretty unusual here. And to be honest, yeah, I've not been to, I've been to one colleague's place here, but that wasn't even to eat. That was just a pass-through kind of thing. So very unusual.
Yeah, I think that most I've been to people's private homes is during funerals.
Yes.
Because, you know, the funerals are usually held at the home, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. So it's a very rare kind of thing. So you've got, as you say, that issue about face, and I think also that issue about family security in terms of providing for the family that also kicks in as a rationale and a thought when they're going out to buy. So, as you say, Clyde, we get into that sort of feel the need to find a house. We go out house hunting. The energy is high. We look at all the options, come back, get depressed, and then it all starts again a few months later.
Well, I'm not sure how it is in the UK. Maybe you give me a little bit of insight. But when I was in college, my wife and I used to go out house hunting, and it was I wouldn't say it was completely pressure free, but it was pretty easy. You just drive around, maybe get a newspaper. There were lots of open houses you could just walk in. It was kind of something you do on the weekend, and it wasn't a lot of pressure. It wasn't a bad thing. And what are you looking at? You're looking at houses that are $200,000, $300,000 in this range. Back when I was a college student, you know, $120,000, $150,000. So, you know, it was not without, you know, it was not beyond possibility to get one, and it was not a high-pressure situation. But I feel when you go out in our example, specifically in Taiwan, but I think it's the same in Hong Kong and in China, there's so many different ways you shop. For example, you buy an apartment that's not even built yet. You buy basically flats. Well, let's specify first. When we say a home in Asia, it's most normally not really a freestanding home.
Yeah.
That would be a flat. That's what you call it in the UK, right? A flat. A condo.
Yeah,
I think we call it a condo in America.
Yeah, which is basically what you're looking at. You're looking at usually a sitting, dining, kind of combined, a kitchen, maybe a couple of bathrooms and your bedrooms all on one level, basically, or typically on one level. That's the fairly typical layout, isn't it?
Yeah, I think if you look at picture number one, we've got these kind of tall high-rises are very typical, where I think in this picture, each one of these floors you're looking at is one person's home, so that's a living room on the right side. On the left side are probably the bedroom, porch. Around the corner is the kitchen.
So it's an all flat layout. Now, what's another alternative is what we see in picture 27, which is more of what they call a tortienne, which is what we'd call the terraced housing. So in other words, all the houses put together in a block. They usually maybe 3-4 stories high. And you walk in. Sometimes it's a shop front, sometimes it's car parking, sometimes it's still living area, and then you go up to your second, third, fourth levels that you know, various things, right from your kitchen to your bedrooms and so on. And usually, of course, what people do on the top floor is that's the ancestors' place. So there's the little shrine there, usually, with the candles, the pictures, various other religious references. But it's very much centered on ancestor worship. Often the older generation will go up there and worship each day. And so that's also then the place for drying the clothes. And I always laugh because from my point of view, I think, hey, you know, this is the best place of the house. But that's also, I guess, the local logic as well.
Yeah, the people fit this in their flats too. On picture 3 and 4, I was just driving around and caught that temple set up in somebody's condo there.
Yeah, so someone I was talking to the other day called it the red shit room, which was not the most polite way of describing it, but we both knew immediately what they meant, which was say a term of abuse. But it was sort of, I think it represented the kind of very different perspective about what that room should be used for from two different points of view. You know, often it's the room with the best view, often it's got the best ventilation, but yet it's very little used. It was kind of a sense of frustration, I think, that was vented there. But yeah, we see that in picture 4. We see in picture 27 the idea of the tortienne, which is this freestanding, which is this terraced house. But then also, which is interesting, you also have the opportunity to buy much, much older property. I mean, in picture 28, we see the older housing, which is 30, 40, a little bit maybe years older. So, you know, relative to some of the stuff that I'd see in the UK, it's not old. But it comes from that early time of rapid growth in Taiwan. And occasionally, too, you can find the older property, which we see in 30, 31, 32, which then is maybe 80, 90 years old, which are much, much older. So those kind of properties do come up onto the market. And we can see that sometimes people actually get quite passionate, and they even start to restore these kind of places for people to live in, to buy. So there is, I think, a small segment that is drawn to the much older properties. But, of course, a lot of it hangs at the front end, which is modern, which is new, which is plush, which is marble, with a lot of interior kind of decoration. In fact, Clyde, I think you went to have a look at one of those very, very sort of upper-end, new kind of properties.
Yeah, I was going to say that these kind of row homes where all these houses are together, and then you have a bottom floor. The big benefit of these is you can run a business in the first floor usually. You can also, because you own the whole building, you can register as a business, whereas if you have a flat in a condo, you have to follow the condo rules, and you can't really get away with that. However, in China, these landed houses are very rare. And in fact, as you know, the land doesn't belong to anyone except the government. So this is part of one of the issues we'll talk about in another show, the economic kind of bubble that's developed, because these places are getting torn down left and right. Just not far from where I am in Beijing, I'm not far from the airport. They've developed this whole super high-end section where foreigners live, and they all, of course, have these big, independent, freestanding, very American-looking homes. And not far away are, just like the pictures you have from Taiwan, these one, two-story houses. They must be 50 to 60 or older years old, and they're all not being upkept, and they're all destined to be razed for the land development, because the government, the local government, sells the land and makes the money. But in Taiwan, of course, the price you're going to pay is huge, because you're paying for that land, James.
Absolutely. You know, when we were walking in Shanghai, in fact, it wasn't this trip, it was the last trip, and I saw a beautiful house set back from the road. I mean, it was an independent house, big. It must have been, I'm struggling to think in meters, but basically it had a long driveway, it had parking, it had this big property, it had a little gatehouse. It was an old place, it was being renovated. But they were talking big money. You were talking 20 to 30 million US dollars for that kind of property in a city location.
And let's emphasize too, also, you will not officially own the land forever.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the other issue. And my wife and I had this sort of small fantasy to own one of these old kind of, I'll say smaller than the one we were looking at there, properties. You know, you often see them in the photos of Shanghai, nice independent kind of house, small yard, this kind of thing. They've all gone. It's just history for those now. So you're back to kind of what we see in Taiwan, which is a lot of apartment blocks going up. So this becomes quite a norm in terms of choice. You know, it's pretty different from what you were talking about there, Clyde, earlier in the US, the kind of yard and your own plot and your house and so on. I mean, we kind of go for that kind of model in the UK as well, which is about you have your own garden and you have your house and your own plot and your own space. That is, a fantasy that's far off from the reality of what happens often in China and Taiwan, isn't it, really, with the housing kind of model?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's easy. A lot of people will use the excuse like Taiwan's land is limited, but you drive around the train all the time, you know, there's tons of unused land. China has, you know, huge tracts of land. A lot of this is just a preference to get a place and be crowded together. People don't mind that crowded together feeling. A lot of people prefer it. And I often know about Chinese friends that move to America, although some really enjoy that, big houses and big yards. Others feel like, you know, gee, this is so scary. I could be murdered one night and nobody even knows that I'm alive or dead. So consumers have a very high acceptance rate of this kind of crowded feeling. So when we go out shopping, I have in picture number 5, I think it is. It's not hard in China or Taiwan to find a realtor. In this photo, there are actually 1, 2, 3, 4 realtors in this one photo. This is within about half a block. The first green sign, then there's a yellow sign, then there's 2 more green signs. All of those shops are realtors. Of course, this is related to the bubble, but it means you can drive almost anywhere. I know you're living down in Tainan. When you're in Taiwan, you can drive anywhere. In Beijing, same thing. I just walk around every shopping mall, every place, even what I was just talking about, this 50, 60-year-old looking buildings. One of the buildings inside there is set up to be a realtor. Every single place you go, you cannot escape these realtors. So they're easy to find, but man, they are hard to deal with. James, you have much experience talking to these guys?
Oh, yes. I was just I was just right with you there, Clive, where you're saying they're sort of everywhere and you drop in, and when you drop in, you get this kind of young kid. I know before the show we were talking a little bit about this, and as you say, typically they're kind of college kids, they're not much experience. Bam, they're right into selling often quite high-end property. You know, we're talking anything maybe even up to $1 million, maybe $2 million or more US dollars. So we're talking some quite high-end stuff, and they're very young, very little experience. You know, you give an indication of preference, and, you know, they'll take you to somewhere completely different, and you wander around, and you ask some basic questions, and they've not got a clue. It's really quite an odd kind of experience I've had, at least personally, and I've been there with my wife, and, you know, we've gone to everything from the very old, like I've got in the photos here, like the 31s and the 32s, through to some stuff that's new. So it's, but hell, you know, I think that realtors or estate agents, as we call them in UK, they all share that kind of common trait, you know.
Well, what shocks me is that you often walk in, and we have a consumer cam of me walking into my latest outing with my wife, one of these buildings. And if you look at some of the pictures I've got, like picture 8, 9, 10, we're actually taking a tour of one of these places. Now, this is related to an earlier show we did. Let me see what show it is. We got a lot of shows here. It was back when you came up to Taichung one day, and we were near a place called Tiger City. Do you remember that?
Yeah, sure. I remember that. It was a great show.
Yeah, well, when we did that show, right next to there was a lot of construction going on, and there's a new high-rise, and that's what I have some pictures of here. We actually went into the high-rise. The developer is selling his properties himself, or the company selling it themselves. So you walk into the first floor, and the whole first floor, instead of being a normal reception area for a building, is now set up for sales. They have models and pictures and all these things. We have a PDF link here where you can actually download all the material I got that day. They take us up to one of the rooms that is empty. They have two different designs, and they take us up to show us both designs, and you can see what it looks like. I think this is not unusual, James. I think you've seen this before. I've seen this in China, too. Basically, what you get is a concrete shell.
I must cut in there, because even before we got to one of these, we went to visit one. And as you say, you're often visiting before the thing's finished. And how did we go up? It was the most frightening experience I've had in my life. We went up on the builder's service elevator. So, you know, it's one of those little kind of, you have those very thin scaffolds that go up, and then you have this kind of miner's box that you're in that's open all the way around and just rattles up to the 10th floor. They swing open the door. There's a 2-foot gap. And you're walking in through the window, basically, and God forbid you look down, because basically there is nothing between you and this 10th floor gap and the floor 10 stories below. So we went in through the window, we got out of this service elevator, I gratefully took someone's hand and bridged the gap, and we were kind of in. And so we had a little adventure even before we actually hit the apartment we were looking at.
Sounds a little bit scary. So that's under construction. Of course, you can buy these kinds of flats even before the construction's begun. They set up a big, it looks like a really fancy 1-2-story building, but actually it's all just made out of plywood. They tear it down as soon as it's done. You walk in and they have the samples, the kitchens and the bedrooms and some mock-up, of course fully furnished, so it looks wonderful. And in your case, you actually went up when it's under construction. I've never done that. That sounds a little bit risky.
Yeah, it was nerve-wracking. And
what floor did you go to?
The 10th floor. This thing was swaying like anything, and I thought there'd be a platform so that we'd kind of bridge the gap, but there's no platform, and you just step across this 2-foot gap and hope that the box doesn't move the wrong way. So, but yeah, as you say, the norm I've seen is these kind of plywood constructions. I remember one going up near my place here. They just buried like about 10 oil barrels full of concrete in the ground, and then bam, 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 they built this mock-up of what the apartment looked like. You walk in, it's the apartment mock-up and the sales center, and that's kind of the norm. And quite often some of these sort of hang on. They don't get ripped off immediately afterwards. One near my place in Taiwan has become a cafe. It's been there now for 2 years. So
converted to a business. That's interesting.
Yeah, kind of Chinese sense of not wasting what could be a structure. So interesting. But as you say, that's the normal you walk in. It looks from the photos, though, Clyde, though, you actually visited something more than a mock-up. But it
no, this was
up.
A real. This is real. The building's all done. And usually, in you know, by the time the building's done, they'll be sold out. So if you're looking, you're just getting resale. I think in this case, this was rather recently, I think the bubble is kind of expanded to almost its maximum expansion. So a lot of buildings are still up by the developer, not sold. So we're able to go upstairs and actually look. And you can see, like, for example, picture 22. This is what the typical flat looks like. It's all concrete. And this relates back to our DIY show, which is show number one. That one reason Chinese aren't big on DIY is because it's kind of hard when you've got to concrete everything. You've got to have, you know the way they put in these wires. You've seen the construction, James, right? They've just concrete everything, and then when they put in wires and piping, they just blast it out, drill it out.
Yeah, so as you can see there in year 22, quite a lot is put in even before the building's done. So it's actually PVC piping installed within the concrete structure. So you can see in 22 you've got some of your sockets and TV and other outlets that are then put in given locations in the wall. And thereafter, as you say, they either bore a great big hole in the wall or you put in some sort of plywood decoration and it's kind of included there.
Yeah, God help you. If something goes wrong with the plumbing, they have to bring in a jackhammer and just rip a huge hole. I mean, you can see that in picture 21. That's really obvious, right? This is the kitchen. So because the kitchen's left more open for you to put in your appliances, there you go. You have a couple open wires, and that's it. So these things are really difficult to deal with.
You know, I was interested in your this picture 21 because on one hand you've kind of got a kitchen, but then the things like the ceiling's not done. It's what the builders would call a first fix. So you've got just the wires coming out of the roof there and the loose plumbing. Was that still partly done, or they'd left it part done there so you could kind of finish it off in your own taste?
Yeah, they say this is like the base kitchen unit that these units come with, and then you have to decide what else you want to do. I think you can buy from them. Of course, they have a whole system set up, or you buy from your own builder who's going to come in and do the work. I think my point is that when you look around this way, this is the first seller. However, James, I don't know your experience. My experience is even this most recent time I go out, even when you're looking at already owned, in other words, it's already been bought and owned for a year, 2 years, 3 years, sometimes 5 years, it's still the exact same thing. I find lots of homes that are for sale from the owner. Now, of course, they go through the real estate companies, and they're still exactly like this.
Yeah. I know, this is kind of interesting, and I think, the story I think almost goes back to your picture number 20. You know, you've got a door, and you open the door, and there's the toilet bowl looking at you. But let's be real about this. This is supposed to be like a $30 million apartment, and you look at that toilet bowl. And what do you see? You see, like, the piping, and you see some random electrical outlets or some other socket there. This, to me, doesn't say quality. You know, it doesn't say $30 million.
Yeah, exactly. And let me say, so this place we're looking at, we got the quotes. Now, of course, the quote you get is going to be quite out of alignment with what the actual price is. But I want to say that the quote I got for this flat, which was approximately $900,000 US, and this is in central Taiwan, Taichung, near the Tiger City area, which is not a super high-end area, nothing special, and in central Taiwan, nothing special there. The economy is okay, but central Taiwan's not doing, super great. It's certainly not an overheating economy. We're talking about prices that you can find flats like that size in New York City.
Yes, yeah, exactly. There's some disconnect, and the point that I was getting at was that as you say, people move in and then maybe they're not sure or what they want to do with it or how it should look, and it stays very barren, very sparse, very, in many respects, I think we can say sort of unsophisticated, perhaps. You know, I think your picture 19 just says it all. It's like this sort of fairly ugly sort of concrete monster of a place, and very little.
Yeah, I mean, it's small too. There's no closets or anything here. Once you put closets in, you don't have much space. And I have colleagues or other professors who have bought in the same area, Central Taiwan, and they're paying very similar prices, upwards approaching $1 million. Now, of course, they borrow the money and all of that. But these prices are really, really hard to justify. And the thing is, this has happened before, James. In the early 90s, I was getting a lot of pressure from other teachers in a school I worked at. And I said something like, well, you know, these housing prices don't seem to be in alignment with reality. If housing prices keep increasing at this rate, you know, you're so out of alignment with inflation, at some point they have to reach infinity. And the answer is always, ha-ha, you foreigners are so stupid, you don't know anything. Chinese property prices never, ever go down, which, of course, now after the bubble bursting in the U.S. and the U.K., I think that, or in Japan in the 90s, you think people learn their lesson, but they don't. So, in Taiwan, did you know that the actual house ownership, home ownership, is up around 90%?
Yeah, we've talked about this, and it's just such a high figure, isn't it? I mean, it's just incredible, that kind of
And building
of,
going on
number.
Everywhere. Everywhere I look, new buildings, which means lots of people own more than one. And that's why I see lots of these places recently where I go in. It's been open for a while. I've been bought for a while, and yet still very bare. It's not meant to be lived in. It's simply another investment.
Yeah, it's seen as a form of investment, which is kind of... it's kind of odd, isn't it? Because when you actually look, and that's why I think we've got a nice contrast in the range of property options that we've been talking about, right from this pretty high end kind of apartment that you visited here, and we've got in these photos in the late 20s photos, and then some of those other ones that I'd visited as well that are the older properties that are 30 years old, maybe a little bit older. So we've got this huge range. And yet, for some reason, these high-end apartments, you and I look at them and we don't see them as high-end. And yet, the price level seems completely, completely out of alignment with what people are looking at.
Well, what were some of the prices you're looking at? Like, I'm looking at these places like on picture 28, you see these kinds of places everywhere in Taiwan, especially down in Tainan, the outskirts of Taichung, I think. Kaohsiung must have a lot of these in the outside areas. What kind of price are we looking at here?
Well, that one, they were, I think the price was on at about 6.5 million. And you can see in like pictures 43, 42, 43, 44, 45, the inside, it's kind of serviceable. If you put on some blinkers and think about how you could change it, refurbish it, you've certainly got refurbishment to do to make it livable. So you're talking maybe a 6.5 price tag. Maybe you might get that, maybe a million, million and a half off that in reality once you negotiate and depending on the desperation of the seller to get shot of it. But then you're looking at another million or so at least to turn it into somewhere where you can start to live and feel comfortable by the time you've done your wiring and your
plumbing. Okay, so if you're talking about 7 million Taiwan dollars, it's approximately $220,000 we're talking about. Now, you see, that's not totally out of alignment, but I think still for what you get, it's a tough...
It's a tough call, isn't it? I mean, when we were talking there, Claire, I was going to say, maybe you don't want to share quite so frankly, but, if you think of the 20 years that you've spent here, I'm just wondering what the math adds up to as a total bill for the rent you've paid while you've
Well, let me
here.
Put it this way. Let me give you a kind of my overall picture on this, and it's I'm sure I'm not the only person. I really think these things are culturally influenced. If you look at other places, I've heard, I don't know this, maybe you can confirm, in Germany, renting is quite normal. People aren't obsessed with buying a house.
I've certainly heard that as a rumor. I can't put a finger on a bit of data that confirms it, but I have a few German friends, and that's a trend they've talked about with me. Yeah.
You know, when I look at the economics, I've been kind of obsessed with exploring the economics of this, and housing is not any different in investment than any others. And in fact, it's a little bit worse because a house doesn't actually produce anything. At least if you take your money, put it in a stock into a company, at least you know there are thousands of people, you know, in Microsoft's case, hundreds of thousands of employees working every day to increase that value. Whether or not they succeed is another question. But overall, all these companies working do. What's a house do? On the other hand, you know, once appreciation comes, people can't help but to see that. So let me give you this little story, which I think tells the whole picture. I think you and I and many people are in. Just before the housing bubble in the U.S. burst, which was, 2008, right? Mm. Just before then, I was often talking to other professors. We all knew it was a bubble. I mean, you were getting email every day, you know, get zero interest loans. You know, you knew it was a bubble. And I went and talked to my wife, who, you know, is Chinese. And she's always been obsessed that we don't own. It's quite embarrassing. Her parents always give us a hard time, you know. And even though nobody would visit your home, it has no purpose. Even though most Chinese homes inside don't have any special decoration, even though you don't even buy a single set of dishes, you know, even though you don't do any of that, you still got to have a home to tell people you have a home and to tell them that you bought an expensive home. Even so, she feels that pressure. And I showed her a graphic. It was a famous graphic on the internet. It was housing prices in the U.S., made into a chart, but the chart was a roller coaster. And so you would see, you know, 1880, 1900, you see this roll, and then the last 15 years, this huge rise in the roller coaster, right? And I said, do you see how out of alignment prices are? This is obvious. She has a PhD in business too. This is obvious. And she just looked at me and said, you see, we should have bought.
She obviously hasn't been on that roller
the receiving
coaster
end, right.
In England, where the roller coaster actually doesn't just go down to the ground level, it goes down a hole as well.
Exactly. Well, that's what's happened in the U.S. now. So, you know, it's always that way when you look at valuations and you say, if I had gotten in at the right time, right? If it's a pyramid scheme, you can make money if you got in at the right time. And this is the excuses people always use. And I find that even Chinese academics and intellectuals are not at all immune from this kind of thinking. That is, well, if as long as I get in on time, I can make it. So anyway, we've discussed this over the years. We've been out shopping. And James, it's just really hard. You know, for me, I'm a very specialization, or I have a huge emphasis, I should say. I have a huge emphasis on cash flow. As far as business goes, I always feel cash flow is important. And I feel the earlier you have cash flow, the better. So I've always been obsessed with this idea of I need to have early cash flow rather than borrowing money for a future income and then paying for it at rates that are hurting my current cash flow. You know, so I've always been adverse to that. And if you buy a $1 million flat, you're buying into the assumption that, you know, someday in the future it's going to pay off way bigger than if you had your money now and you could invest it or use it in your business or something like that. And so I've always been confident in my ability to make money now, invest it for the future rather than to borrow from that future and bring it back to now. And so my wife agrees, kind of, and it's really hard to look at these, especially these flats, like my example here. Some of yours are probably a better deal, but the things I'm looking at, there's just no way these places can ever make that money back unless it's on a speculative opportunity.
Clyde, as you're talking here, I was just writing on a piece of paper. What am I writing? I'm writing down and thinking how much rent I pay here. I pay 10,000 Taiwanese a month. So what's that in US dollars? That's around... I need your help because you're more of a dollar man than I am.
You pay 10,000 NT, is that what you said?
Yes.
About 320 US dollars a month?
Yeah, that should be about right. And then there's another 10%, rough, no, yeah, 10-15% there for the management fee. So that's for the guards and the general maintenance, and another another 15% for the car parking. Sometimes we sublet that. So,
this is the Guanli Fei. This is the management fee, right? And this is another thing my wife despises, because we're looking at some of these places and they're talking like 5,000-6,000 NT a month, and our rent is about one third more than that whole price just for the management fee, which is totally lost money.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you pay that management fee, and okay, it's kind of nice. You do have people, the guards that take care of things, they get to know you, they're very helpful and so on. And then it's, you know, the wider maintenance of the building area, the roofing and all the rest of it. So it kind of, you know, it is maintenance, it has to be paid, but some of them do get way extortionate. Ours is kind of middle of the road. And, you know, but you add that up over a year. I mean, you're saying, I guess you pay like about 100,000 Taiwanese a year. I'm paying more. I haven't got my cash flow mindset as tight as you have. So I'm, you know, I'm up probably around 140 or so thousand a year. But dollar-wise, US dollars, when you look at that, it's so tiny, isn't it?
Yes, the rent, that's the key. If you look around and you don't have expectation of living like, you know, a kind of foreigner lifestyle, and in your case, I think you live a little bit of a better lifestyle housing than I do. I'm kind of basically the bottom of the barrel, it's true. Many friends come over to visit and say, I can't, you know, you really live Chinese, don't you? I think our friend Michael Turton, he actually rents a whole house and has a little yard. It's outside the city, but it's a pretty good deal for what he gets. And the key there is you add that money up. The typical UK mindset, an American mindset, I think, is when you're paying rent, you're giving the money away. But, man, if you took all this and you borrowed from your future income to buy a $1 million flat without any certainty or cash flow that's going to come back, and negative cash flow, if you buy one of these flats in these high-rises, you have to pay the management fee whether you live there or not.
Yeah, absolutely. When you actually do that math, it makes the equation of buying so much harder. And it was a big shock for me, you know, coming, as you say, from the UK mindset, because, yeah, typically property does appreciate. There's quite a heated market in UK, and I think I've not actually looked at the numbers, drawn the graph, but typically property does rise. It does follow the mantra that no one's making any more land, more people are getting wealthier, more people want better housing, more people want older housing, all the rest of it. It does tend to drive up the house prices in UK. Yeah, there's bubbles. It sort of does the soar effect, but the angle of the saw tends to be upwards appreciation. In other words, you buy a property, yeah, you might go through a bubble, yeah, it might drop off, but hey, 5 years later, you're still going to be in the good through buying. Coming here to the Chinese space was a real eye-opener, because you basically suddenly have that realization. You buy an apartment, it looks nice, it's got all this marble and this sort of decor inside. The thing will almost certainly depreciate. You've paid all this money for a place that actually is going to go down in value. You know, and I mean, an example is a business person I was talking to the other day, and he bought his house for about just over 10 million. His wife has done a lot of work in it, put in beautiful furnishings. It's now, you know, total spend is around 20 million. He says, if I sell now, I might get 11 or 12.
Really?
Yeah.
And that was in Tainan, was it?
That's in Tainan, yeah. I don't think this is unusual. You know, and it's that the place is beautiful inside. His wife is a fanatic for detail. I mean, you know, where people sort of put up with slightly bulging walls, or, you know, the finish not being quite tight, their place is immaculate. It even uses some hotel grade doors and this kind of thing. It's beautiful. But he says that's reality. You know, when I sell it, I know I am never going to recoup this money. And I think that's a general point and a general reality. The pictures of the apartment you've shown us here as we've been talking, if you furbish that up to look the money, basically, I am quite sure you'd never recover it. I'm sure we must be on the same page on that.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the roller coaster example. It's easy for me to say. I said it 10 years ago, I said it 5 years ago, and I'm still saying it, and we're still going out looking for houses, and everybody's telling us how stupid we were. We didn't get in at the bottom, and now we're screwed.
Yeah, but I think the thing that's even more fundamental is that here, that will depreciate, and you'll almost guarantee to lose money if you resell, buying one of these new, beautifully kind of furbished places. Because almost the reality is the next purchaser will move in, and before they move in, what will they do? They'll call in their builders, they'll rip all this stuff out. You know, this kitchen we're looking at here in photo 15, bam, gone. You know? And the value is so out of alignment. You know, and that's really what's put me off even thinking of purchasing. The only time I think I might purchase is when you're getting a repossession and you're buying land that's actually close to the government market price, or sometimes even below it, when at least then you know that the possibility of making a dramatic loss is very, very negligible and almost certainly zero.
It's a good
very
point.
Different market, I think.
I think when we're looking, if we get something, we're really looking for something with a first floor, we can rent it out to a business, we can at least have a cash flow, and then we can register our business there. At least it has some application, but that's not the most common type of housing. And what we're seeing in China especially is these just explosion of these condos, especially the high-end stuff, and really, really a difficult market. And I think from a consumer point of view, if you're a retailer or you're a company that's looking at consumers in China, this really sucks down everybody's money, period.
Absolutely. I mean,
not filling the house, not even filling, just getting the house and leaving it empty. Your money's all gone.
It's a great market if you're in construction, for sure. Great market.
Yeah, well, of course, that's the whole cycle, right? Everyone involved in this, it's in their interest to get those prices high, right? Everyone, and in China, especially even the government, because they're the ones initially selling the land, right? So everyone's involved in that except the consumer. And boy, I just think the consumer's tough. And a lot of people overseas, as we began this, when we began today, we're talking about it's the Chinese who are buying the bonds. They're all loaded. They're all safe. And my response is, yeah, in a way that's true. I think there's more millionaires in China now than Europe. Sometime in the future, there'll be more millionaires in China than in the USA. So there's a luxury market, right? Well, yeah, I guess. A lot of that extra income, where does it go? Speculation into the market. Getting these kinds of flats, jacking up the prices, making those bubbles. And then regular consumers who are working day to day who aren't millionaires, they're having to absorb that, and they get the next 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years in debt to pay it. And I have an interesting number in Singapore, which has experienced the exact same thing. In Singapore, I heard a report one day that said, you know, housing prices in Singapore are not unreasonable because you can still get a mortgage for 60 years. So they're actually, their idea of reasonableness, of course, I think we've often heard about this, the reasonableness of the prices, how many years you need to take out the mortgage, right? 20, 30 years. They've extended this number up to 60 freaking years. I mean, you know, well, if the price goes up more, then what are we talking about? It's like after death.
Well, even at 60 years, you must be looking at your kids taking it on.
Exactly, which is a good point, because you know in Taiwan, your children are responsible for your debt. So I guess that's the idea. You just push it off to your kids, and then they'll be in debt for these crappy houses. So, you know, I think that kind of brings us full circle. Yeah, lots of money floating around, but don't assume too much, because there's something about the culture where there's a huge emphasis, you've got to get a home, and because of that emphasis, it distorts the market. People feel a lot of pressure, they don't like to rent, and they buy, and then the people with money use it to speculate, and the market gets into this kind of situation. I have to say, out of all the professors I work with, I don't know anybody who rents.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, most have moved to that space, and I think it's such an interesting situation because, as you say, Clyde, we come in with a, of course, a Western you know, strongly Western perspective on, you know, having a home. And of course, also the idea of, you know, the financial element of that. And I think we look at it in a slightly different way, as we've talked about here. You know, what does it mean spending that money, and where's my money going, and you know, what sort of return can I get from that, and also the, you know, the gut feeling of wanting a place that's your own, and you know, the old adage that an Englishman's home is his castle, and all these sort of things, parameters kick in. But then you have the local perspective, where issues about face and having a home and saying how much it costs and where it is become very, very, very powerful driving forces. And I find it an interesting, almost contradiction, that those very same people you can find down in the markets, in the day markets, the wet markets, often, you know, that they'll be buying fresh produce there. They'll be still the ones who are picking over each bean, each apple, each chicken to examine whether the quality's right.
And then, yeah, well, no wonder.
These huge places yeah. that have sucked out this vast amount of money.
There's exactly.
This interesting
exactly.
Sort of anomaly. And often we see these things in the Chinese space, but it's very, very interesting how all I can attribute to it is these very powerful social pressures that then distort the mindset, and people do lose sense of the idea of value and price, and the cost-conscious element somehow is distorted within this market. It's a very interesting but also frustrating space to be in.
Yeah, tell me about it. Well, I'm going to be jumping on an airplane in a couple days, heading back to Taiwan and house hunting again.
Good luck with that. I should call it your hobby, and I should just say happy visiting, because I don't think you're going to be getting your checkbook out, certainly
no,
not for that
no.
house.
No, you either, I should say, because last time we were in Shanghai together, you were going to go out. I remember your wife saying, please don't go with me. It's like having a tattoo on your head. Rip me off.
Yeah, don't talk about that fantasy. We put that firmly in the trash can now.
Yeah, being a foreigner looking in the market doesn't help much. That's for darn sure. All right, James,
great.
Good show and interesting topic. And I think next time we get together, we're going to expand a little bit more to talk about another aspect of the real estate market, maybe a little bit more about the economics and how that's all come about.
Yeah, and the whole purchase
this
process.
This is Talk of Asian Marketing
all right,
with a special emphasis on localized Chinese consumer behavior. Our website is ccc.qbook.tv. where you can find other audio and video episodes with photos, links, and information related to today's conversation. Subscribe to leave comments and access research episodes with applied topics and research reports.